cross-section cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute and a half past the hour. This is Friday on the front porch on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Horn. Conversation radio. Unlike any other. Available only on the internet. Or we are not constrained by FCC censorship obligations. You see. Friday on the front porch, the 11th of November, 2011. There's a certain numerical symmetry to that, isn't there? 11, 11, 11. Artificial though it is, it's entirely created. It's not like the Fibonacci sequence or anything. It's entirely artificial. It is Veterans Day. It is Veterans Day. But long before there was ever a Veterans Day, there was something else entirely. And the something else was called Armistice Day. And for the past several years, I have tried to encourage people, in the course of honoring all veterans, to pay especial attention to the origins of what we call Veterans Day that lie in the signing of the armistice, which brought to an end the conflagration that changed the very nature of life as we understood it, namely World War I. Everything changed in August of 1914. You know, I've mentioned several times of late that I went and reread Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August, which is about the outbreak of the First World War. One of the great talents of the human mind is its ability to forget, if we may call that a talent. It is profound indeed. We forget words like Ardennes and Marne and Somme. We forget place names like Liège, Namur, Louvain. And in forgetting those things, we forget that we don't have any especial right to consider ourselves civilized, just, or humane. Horrors unfolded in the First World War, which sadly we are proving ourselves quite good at forgetting, but at the same time run as a sort of undercurrent even to this day. It will, in a short span of time, a little over 2 years, be the 100th anniversary, hard as it is to believe, of the horror that unfolded in Belgium and France, and persisted in trenches and across barbed wire, in the cries of gas, gas of that era. As is often the case, the United States tends to define things only by its own participation. We tend to forget that the world had been at war since 1939, because we only entered the Second World War in 1941, and late at that. For the United States, the Second World War was a war that didn't quite last 2 2/3 years. It was much longer elsewhere. So to the First World War. We entered in 1917. It was over in 1918. Meanwhile, 1915, 1916, and a plentitude of horror in 1914 defined its scope. We forget that at our peril. I was watching some program the other day. Oh, God, don't send me email. I think it was Morning Joe. And Mike Barnicle took exception to a description offered by the blonde lady about how the French view us, how a French exchange student had drawn pictures to describe French attitudes toward Americans, and he bristled up and he got all, well, maybe those little French children need to go to Normandy and see all the names on all the crosses. As if only America saved France. It's kind of the way we are, I guess. And more is the pity. But we would do well to remember the First World War and the real reason for November the 11th being a day of remembrance. Because this is the first year that we will be doing so without a living soul upon the planet who participated in it. I thought of that earlier today, and it struck me, whether it strikes you the same way, it struck me as profound. When that day comes, when there is no longer anyone alive who can remember an event firsthand, and all events are so marked, then the duty falls to those who come afterward to do all they can to know the event's truths and to remember them well and as accurately as they have the capacity so to do. I thumbed through some old photo albums today and saw pictures of my forebears in those doughboy uniforms with their puttees and their tunics and their, what do you call those helmets with the wide round top and the wide brim? I mean, I don't know. And I thought about them. And it seems especially odd to me that, or not odd, but striking, really, striking, to recognize that here I stand, 48, almost 49 years old. The beginning of the First World War is 98 years old, 50 years older than I. And I can tell my children that I actually had conversations as a child with American men who had been gassed in the trenches, who heard artillery shells falling at such a rapid and constant rate that their very beings were shattered by the persistence of the concussions. That's an amazing little bit of time travel. I don't mean to diminish the memory of the service of other veterans. That is not my purpose in these remarks. Rather, I find it kind of insulting that we as a people are so damned parsimonious with our days of remembrance. November the 11th is Armistice Day. It's the way that I was raised. Perhaps because my parents were marking Armistice Day as children in the 1930s during the Depression, before there was a World War II to remember, before they even knew there was a Korea on the map. God knows of Vietnam in Iraq or in Afghanistan. So I was raised with November 11th being Armistice Day. It seems to me that our veterans should have a day all their own, without the freight of the horrors and history of one particular war. That we should, on one day and one day only, take time for them outside the confines of shattered history. But it is a day of remembrance. The photographs that look down at us from our walls here took on a special aura of relevance. My father, his Navy cap perched jauntily on his head. His brother, in the uniform of a U.S. Army sergeant, with a happy gleam in his eye. My father came home, his brother did not. And my having grown up listening to stories by my father of all the people that he knew and loved aboard ship, and I just sat in a quiet room recalling those names, all of them all gone, but deserving of our memories. And I hope you have all had a little time for that today as well. Yeah, David in Tennessee noting that there was no particular nickname for the U.S.'s steel helmet of that era. Nothing so vivid a descriptor as coal scuttle affixed to the German World War II helmets. I believe the coal scuttles were also in use in the First World War as well. A study of the origins of the First World War really gives you a sense of just how things can go hopelessly wrong incredibly quickly. Because it was a study in the foolhardiness of that crowd on this planet who refers to themselves as royalty, as having better blood than the rest of us. In the movie Matewan by John Sayles, the union organizer a character by the name of Joe Keenihan, who was entirely fictional, discusses with a young character in the film at one point the fact that, yes, he spent time in Leavenworth during the First World War before, because he refused to go and serve. And he talks about the historically verifiable fact that, for instance, other draft resistors, like the Amish, were tortured by the American government for their refusal. And at one point, the character says, and I think it is valid, "All I seen was workers killing workers. And how true that is." There's a phrase for that. So it seemed appropriate just to remember, and specifically remember, the First World War, from whom we get this day, from whom we got the vast majority of the 20th century's art, literature, politics, economics, technology. Where I grew up, there was a vast complex of armaments, the chemical munitions manufactories, that after the First World War, in the First World War, they were building nitrogen-based explosives. Nitrates. And after the First World War ended, in a desperate attempt to try to extend that economy, you get nitrate fertilizers. And that creates an entire industry that we deal with to this day. There is little about the modern world that did not arise out of the First World War or give birth to something that arose out of the Second. All the way up to the Cold War, the Pentagon and the various military-industrial complexes of Western and Eastern Europe were planning for wars that would be fought similarly to the First and Second. Massed navies, dreadnoughts, masses of rolling artillery, air power. And it may be that much of that has come to naught, that future war will not look like that. The sad thing is that we consider that there will be future war. And at some point, you would like for our betters, for they are the ones who start these things, to learn to study war no more. Well, hope in one hand and in the other, and see which one fills up first. So that's just a general mention of the remembrance of the day, and I hope you had some reflective time as well. 20 minutes past the hour, a little break, and we'll come back. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid. from his first solo album, that is Sting and Children's Crusade. The solo album was The Dream of the Blue Turtles. About 25 minutes past the hour, and by the way, I've launched off into the remembrance of Armistice Day before I could apologize for playing hooky last night. I really, really did play hooky last night. But I did it for what I hope will prove, or will be, a good reason. And that is, I was, well, last night was the last chance for me to see the high school play in which my two daughters were appearing. And as a consequence, I took the night off and we went up and even videotaped it. It was quite enjoyable. Yes, dear?
You didn't take... you didn't really take the night off, and you weren't playing hooky. You were being daddy, and you were being Agnes's love slave.
Okay, that may be a little TMI.
Because you love me, you went, and we had a great time.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. And I was ever so proud. You know, if you ever consult the... there's a list out there somewhere of the things that human beings fear most. Number two is death. Number one is speaking in public. So, consequently, I am proud of my daughters. You know, I've missed some shows and stuff to go and watch Ferg play football and so forth, and I owed this to my daughters to go and see them putting the talents that Agnes and I have tried to instill in them or develop in them to work. So that's where I was last night. And yes, my daughters are bitten by the thespian bug. Now stop it. Thespian. T-H-E-S-P-I-A-N. Thespian. But it was a pleasant undertaking. And I thank you for your forbearance and understanding. I want to share an email with you right quick, because it's sort of a testament, if you will, to the bonds of family that happen here on the Horn, and it seems like Friday on the Front Porch is an appropriate place for it. You know, we had a lot of raw emotions come out last week, following the revelations of that god-awful monster of a human being in Texas and his beating of his daughter. And I got an email from Ray last night, and he told me I could share this, so I'm a goner. But, I just want this to be... It humbled and inspired me. Because there just aren't a lot of places where people at great and attenuated distances feel comfortable talking with people they've never met, but with whom they've developed a sense of real connection. There just aren't a lot of places where that happens, and I am particularly proud that this is one of those places. Ray wrote in and he said, "It's taken me a while to formulate how to bear myself in this email. The daughter of Judge Adams certainly scratched the surface of many souls in the Horn family. I was horribly abused as a child in pretty much every way. While I don't go into details, it was made horribly worse in that I was all alone in the world. Last week I heard a lot of pain and rage and sadness, but I also heard a lot of hope and courage. You handled your job as ringmaster, Dr. Melfi, with great humanity." And then he says this, and I just feel like I need cold water thrown on me or something. "I truly believe you're the best talk radio I've ever heard." Wow. Thank you. "Please pass on that I respect and admire Cassie. She will be a great woman." And then this, says Ray. In light of current events, I hope a tiny beam of light is shown into the dark closets where other little rays hide in loneliness and pain, hoping only for someone to care. And that image that Ray conjured stayed with me. The idea of children hiding from their tormentors and their attackers. And of course, it only gets worse as we consider the ever-increasing horror that was that transpired in that little place in Pennsylvania that they call Happy Valley. The Penn State story, you know by now all the details. We don't need to go into a bunch of them, but yesterday I watched and watched and watched and read and read and read with this increasing sense of disgust. The rioters in State College there in Happy Valley, who came out in the middle of the night, who bashed in windshields, who overturned probably $1 million broadcast media truck, all in support of a man who couldn't even find it in what was left of his soul to call the police when one of his longtime friends was caught in flagrante delicto in the midst of raping a little boy. And thousands of young people came out into the streets in Happy Valley to defend an enabler of child rape. One of them carried a homemade sign, or two of them, because I saw two people, I saw two sets of hands holding it up for the camera. Two of my favorite J's are Jesus and Joe Pa. I tweeted that photo and it went onto my Facebook page. You can find it if you want to see it. Two of my favorite J's are Jesus and Joe Pa. Suffer the little children to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven. You must have the faith of a little child. These were the things that Jesus said about little children. Not, we discussed the matter and I called the athletic director and dropped it in his lap. But on the same evening that students at the University of California, Berkeley were being beaten with truncheons and later arrests took place for their having had the temerity to speak truth to power and demand a measure, a quantum of simple fairness in this rapidly degenerating, corporatized, profit-fueled, greed and avarice-driven nation. At the same time that was happening, a few kids in Happy Valley got some pepper spray on them because they decided to take bricks, rocks, and bats to people's vehicles in support of a man whom we now must rather consider in the light of being a monster, whose best response to a man being caught raping little boys in his football team showers was to take his keys away. And those two incidents placed side by side or head to head really told me so much more than I guess I really needed to know about where America stands right now, this instant here. For you see, Penn State University, as Mike Elk noted in a piece that he wrote, drawing on the piece written by Dave Zirin from Edge of Sports, the Penn State disaster is a disaster of white privilege. Those were, in the vast majority, young white people in the streets protesting, breaking windows, throwing rocks, and screaming, and declaring that their two favorite Jays were Jesus and Joe Pa. White privilege is very real, and white privilege is very, very, very dangerous. I'm sure if you think about it, you can find something that's wrong in the world that was brought about by people who aren't white, but the problems of the world that were brought about by people who are is a hell of a lot longer. And as Mike Elk noted, in Happy Valley, State College, Pennsylvania, they didn't like it that their white privilege was being threatened, as manifested in the person of Joe Paterno. And of course, it got worse. The story just kept getting worse. I don't aim to rumor monger or anything along those lines, but this kind of begs a mention. I got it both from Nancy and from Sandra, this story. And when I read it, I felt like my head had just gone on a swivel, moving through 360 degrees atop my neck. Breathtakingly horrifying. Because it turns out one of the people who early on sort of hinted at what was to come from the Penn State, later to come from the Penn State Joe Paterno Jerry Sandusky scandal, has yet more information. And that information, wowzer. Well, I'll let the article speak for itself. This particular article comes from a writer by the name of Zach Wassing, writing at Yahoo. The title alone should give you the blind shivers. It did me. Headline, Penn State scandal, rumors claim Sandusky pimped out boys to rich donors. David in Tennessee commented on the article to me and told me he kind of did a little rudimentary number crunching and said that with Jerry Sandusky having retired from coaching around 1995, that really he didn't have the kind of cake to be leading the kind of life he was leading, so there was either some hush money flowing his way or some other form of commerce. Zach Wassink writes the following. Just when you thought the Penn State child sex abuse scandal couldn't possibly get any worse, we may have just scratched the surface. Joe Paterno being fired could be just the start of arguably the biggest downfall in the history of college athletics. Pittsburgh radio personality Mark Madden, who penned a column for the Beaver County Times back in April of this year named Sandusky's Estate Secret. A column which foreshadowed the recent scandal and which has absolutely gutted those of us in the Penn State family, was a guest on the Dennis and Callahan Morning Show on WEEI Sports Talk Radio out of Boston on Thursday morning. Past. You know, yesterday. During his appearance, Madden, who has been mostly correct regarding the issue from the very start, dropped what can only be called a bombshell, an announcement which could mean far more than the end of Joe Paterno's career. Madden stated that two prominent columnists are currently investigating a rumor that Jerry Sandusky's Second Mile Foundation, a nonprofit organization aimed to serve underprivileged youths, was, quote, pimping out young boys to rich Penn State donors. If I'm ruining anybody's supper, I apologize. Misery loves company. It ain't doing nothing for my digestive tract, neither. Madden went on to say that Jerry Sandusky was told by those running the show at Penn State Football that Sandusky had to retire after allegations made in 1998 that the defensive coordinator was guilty of improper conduct with an underage male. Sandusky, thought by some to be Joe Paterno's successor at the time, abruptly and somewhat shockingly retired from coaching in 1999. Wasink continues, "It actually gets worse. Madden went on to say, when Sandusky quit," this is a quote, "when Sandusky quit, everybody knew. Not just at Penn State. It was a very poorly kept secret around college football in general. That is why he never coached in college football again and retired at the relatively young age of 55, young for a coach." Madden also called the Second Mile Foundation the perfect cover for Sandusky's scheme. Wasink reiterates, "These reports, as of the writing of the piece, are coming only from Mark Madden, and they are only rumors and speculation. But he has been, Mark Madden, mostly correct about a grand jury investigation which was sealed until very recently." But he continues, "Late Wednesday evening, after Joe Paterno was fired by Penn State, an in-the-know individual told him that this story was going to get uglier, and that there were, at the very least, dozens of more victims." Dozens more victims. My absolute fear regarding the issue is what Mark Madden spoke on Thursday morning. It's been widely reported that the U.S. Department of Education is currently investigating Penn State University. Are they going to find that Jerry Sandusky was running a multi-million-dollar criminal organization, one which resulted in dozens, possibly hundreds or even more, of youths being sexually abused? Will they find that higher-ups at Penn State, including now former football coach Joe Paterno, covered up Sandusky's heinous crimes? All I know this morning is that after the worst week of my Penn State life, I don't know if anything more would shock me." And you know what a kind of a geek I am for college football, right? I've been thinking hard about this whole thing. You know, Joe Paterno was referenced in a very short list of iconic college football coaches. Names like Bryant and Bowden, but particularly the old school coaches. Frank Howard at Clemson, a teammate of Bryant's, comes to mind. I thought about people like Chuck Jordan at Auburn. And even Woody Hayes, Ara Parseghian, the guy up at Michigan. I'll get letters from the Michigan fans. There is something to this. You know, those men would work a young man. They would work him till his sweat was blood, till his snot was vomit, and until he was like unto dropping toward the greater goal of creating a winning football team. And if a scandal like what Joe Paterno countenanced had broken at any one of their schools, those men would have been out of a job too. The difference being that those men would have been out of a job because they would have had to have been pried off of the offender as they tried to kill him with their bare hands. I sincerely believe that, understanding how dangerous belief is. But I do. But Joe Paterno didn't try to put his hands around Jerry Sandusky's neck. Yeah, Bo Schembechler at Michigan, General Nayland at the University of Tennessee. Yeah, dare we forget Newt Rockne? How about Eddie Robinson? How about Amos Alonzo Stagg, the father of them all? Any one of those men would have committed a felony of his own to stop conduct such as Sandusky's, but not Paterno, because Paterno, in a very conservative, very right-wing, very registered Republican community, had to protect the prophets. And that's what this story is. This is a story of prophets. It is not a sex scandal, as some in the for-profit media have referred to it. It is a rape horror. And Sandusky is allegedly a serial rapist. Not a damn bit different from the Hillside Strangler or John Wayne Gacy or any of the rest of the psychotics who prey upon the weak and the defenseless. Someone over at Salon did take time to note that Jerry Sandusky is, of course, a registered Republican. So, too, is Joe Paterno. The ever-so-prissy and precious for-profit media immediately jumped on that individual. How dare you try to equate that monster's conduct with his political affiliation? There's no correlation, damn it! There's no correlation! Yes, there is. There's a huge correlation. And an inescapable one if one will only bother to look. But you see, we can't look like that because then the whole sideshow freakorama that is right-wing politics might come crashing down and go to its monster's grave where it belongs to be ringed in garlic and crosses and mirrors all around with people armed with firearms filled with nothing but silver bullets, should any of them ever try to get up out of their filthy crypt. That's unfair. How unfair is it? You look at the field of Republicans and tell me. Mark in Florida noting, like a natural resource exploited, this ring may have extended naturally, or nationally. RepublicanSexOffenders.com shows a predilection for children in, including the kidnapping of a Des Moines paperboy at the age of 12. Oh, I understand, Mark. RepublicanSexOffenders.com shows a predilection for children in the 41 George H.W. Bush White House, including the kidnapping of Des Moines paperboy Johnny Gosch at age 12. Sandusky was a speaker for a GOP rally for George H.W. Bush, a lead speaker. Oddly enough, no one's gone to ask George H.W. Bush about his old pal, Jerry Sandusky. Yeah. So, just a few initial thoughts. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Yeah, Sandra.
Oh, my God. Listen, I can't even believe the state of the Penn State situation. I mean, we have a situation where this sort of prized institution has been used to lure in, stressed out parents who think maybe their kids can get some better direction, you know?
Right.
And what they get is rape. And this is such a bigger question. I mean, you got people calling into shows talking about, oh, no, we can't cancel the season. It's like, my God, I don't, the attitude is just so beyond the beyond. The school should have its program ended. The death penalty that they put on programs for far lesser offenses should be applied to this school for at least 5 years. I don't even understand. I can't even believe that they're talking about whether or not to play the damn game on Saturday. They need to end the season and really consider shutting them out for a while, because the institution has to be shown to be venal and wrong because of how it was used to get children.
That's,
I mean, it's horrifying.
As sick as I feel saying this, Sandra, I'm going to say it anyway. There would be a substantial difference in this story if Jerry Sandusky had been out trolling bus stations. Okay? Do you understand what I'm getting at? But he was using, as you note, the entire structural apparatus of the university.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that, to me, also separates, you know, you get rid of the people, put them in jail, whatever you have to do, but you're looking at underserved, underprivileged, at-risk youth using sports and a well-known institution as a means to get their self right. But what do they get instead? I mean, to me, that is the ultimate crime right in this story right now. And for anybody to be talking about anything other than decertifying that program in some manner, I don't want to hear nothing else. I could care less about the games they have left or on and on and on. And, it seems to be, I notice that the tenor is changing. People are freaking out. So I don't know what the end result will be, but it's not cool to be talking about their last four games or whatever. I'm like, wow,
Sandra, operating from the assumption that they will play the game tomorrow against Nebraska and that it is their last home game of the season, as I understand it, what will it say when that stadium is full to capacity, standing room only, with fans?
I also heard some comment from the administration talking about, well, you know, Joe can turn up as any member of the public can. That's how they framed it. You know, and it's just like, oh, no, none of that is, the thing is, none of it is enough. I guess maybe Happy Valley or whatever the hell it's called is sort of in a bubble, because for outsiders like me looking in, I'm like, oh no, this is way disturbing. Like those white men who are rioting, it's like, hello.
Well, let me put a little perspective into this. Do you remember a story from last football season? It was a couple who drove down from Michigan to see Michigan play Penn State. And,
oh, yeah, and they were harassed. Yeah,
because they were a mixed-race couple.
Right.
And
right.
White people in the stand tortured them every second that they sat in their seats.
And they had some Michigan gear on or something?
I think maybe they did, but it was the mixed-race aspect that got the name-calling done.
Well, no, I understand, but, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, how would they have stood out? I mean, I don't even understand the dynamics. You're telling me that there's no other dark? I mean, you know what I'm saying about the whole setup just sounds way weird. That's why I asked if they had some stuff.
I think there was some Michigan gear involved, yeah.
Because, anyway, I'm sorry, you can go ahead.
Well, no, the administration, and this sort of, I was thinking about this yesterday before showtime. The administration's response was the typical, well, you know, Penn State is a better place than that, and we certainly want to apologize to these people. All the time that kind of thing was coming out, every time that Penn State has dealt with a controversy, it's important to me, Sandra, to note that every time they've dealt with a controversy, Penn State has known to the highest levels of its operational capacity, Penn State has known that it was covering up child rape. And not just child rape, but a systematic perpetration of repeated serial child rape.
Yeah, now we have discussions of some sort of trafficking, you know, providing boys for rich folks. I mean, this story can't get any more deprived and degenerate, and I don't give a F. They're all effing Republicans, conservative Republicans. And I'm going to tie it to the story every time I mention it. I don't give a F. Because to me, these self-righteous pigs are forever worrying about family values, and every other day, they are embroiled in some of the most sickest shit on this planet. And it's sickening that we can't bring it up. All of a sudden, it's taboo.
Yeah, well, let's go ahead and say the next thing, Sandra. There's a line that runs from Jerry Sandusky to Herm Cain.
Well, and also the Santorum connection. It's like, oh, yeah, motherfucker, you know, he's suspect anyway. But to hear his name thrown into this, too, I'm like, yeah, we know what you really are. You know, he's depraved. I know it. I know he a deviant. Because he too wedded to all the sort of reproductive shit that's abnormal in men.
Look, when you're bringing home the dead fetus to show to your toddlers?
No, it's abnormal. When men are going off on the deep end about it, I'm like, something's wrong with you. I don't care. That's just my thought as a woman. I'm like, what the fuck? What are you talking? You know, why do you care? You know, because they don't care about other normal, familiar type things. So when they care so much about what's going on in my womb, I'm like, you know, no, you're a sociopath. So he's something wrong with him. And yes, just because he's associated with it, I'm condemning him because he's a right winger. And by virtue, they're fucked.
Yeah. The sad thing is, you know, we're having this conversation, but in the larger panorama of the national discussion, we can't.
Unless they were Democrats.
Yeah, well, sure. Absolutely. I heard the other day, you know, I don't know if you saw this vicious comment that came out from L. Lynn, whatever her name is, that's the lawyer for Cain, about how any woman coming forward had better, by God, think twice.
Yeah, all right. So witness intimidation.
Right. That is that's got to be unethical lawyer conduct under just about any state's code of professional responsibility.
Well, now listen. I mean, to me, you know, it just sort of speaks to, you know, our constant theme these days, at least mine, the idea that, you know, which that Glenn Greenwald articulates really well, is that where inequality was acceptable, the idea that justice was available across the board, so that made the inequality palatable. Now, that justice is also unequal. And this is where the whole thing blows up, because you have no area in our life where people are treated in a common fashion anymore. When you have that dynamic, the society is done.
Yeah, and it extends further. For instance, if you complain, and I mean, I've seen it time and again, and we've talked about it some here. If you complain, for instance, about gay teenagers being bullied into suicide, the right wing has framed that in such a way as to say that to tell them that they are not allowed to torture people is a violation of their religious liberty.
And they codified it in law in Michigan. You know about that law in Michigan, right?
What?
It was passed under the name of a gay student that was bullied. I don't know if the kid died, but it was one of those sort of laws. The Republicans in Michigan managed to put, well, that's fine, except if you have a belief that it's wrong, then you're not covered under this anti-bully statute. I can't remember the name of it. I'll see if I can find it.
Oh, so the religious monsters get a pass?
Right, and this has been passed. It is horrific. It makes it even worse. It gives a pass now to people to torment the kids under the name of a child that was bullied to death, as far as I can tell. Now, I'm sorry I don't have all the information, but I'll get it to you, because it's just horrific. It's like, that's exactly what you're talking about. But there is a law in this country now reflecting that type of mentality.
Jesus,
you know,
God.
I wish I remember the name, but I'll find it, because that is something that popped in my mind a few days ago. I thought, oh, my God, when I heard about it. So, because it was an impassioned teacher, I think she used to be a teacher, but she's a assembly person in Michigan, made a speech on the floor, which was, like, just chilling. You know, how she called it for what it was. So anyway, I got to find that, because I think you would appreciate it. But yeah, no, and I don't want to make the Penn State completely, you know, a whole indictment of everything. But you really can draw so much from that situation about the state of our country. Because when you have people calling in on one side or the other, how are you having one side or the other in this story, Bob?
See, I don't get that either. But I got a note from David in Tennessee where he just happened to be up and listening to the radio, local radio down there, the Nashville way, at about 5:30 in the morning, which is not a good time to listen to talk radio anywhere.
Oh, wait, okay.
You know, because that's when you get the real live wires picking up the phone.
Yeah.
And he said he heard a caller to sports radio in Nashville call in and say, well, see, this here Penn State sex scandal, what it is you got to understand that now that we've got the homosexuals adopting children, well, that's happening in all kinds of American homes now. And see, Cephas didn't come up with that line by himself. He's heard it in a pulpit. He's received it on a right-wing blast email. He read it. Cephas.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah.
but it, you know, because the right wing do not have original ideas. Everything that passes for an idea in the right wing is manufactured and passed out to a squad of people who, when told to march, do so promptly. So instead of being a sociopathic serial criminal case, the right wing is already hard at work, Sandra, trying to cast this as a homosexuality problem.
Oh, no. I mean, it's just absurd on the face, because, you know, how the hell do they get past the power dynamics of it? I mean, screw I'm not buying it in any form outside of preying on the weak. That's the frame I'm looking at.
And it's inescapable to the you, the me, the Horn family, normal people. But no, because you see, the right wing, Sandra, has never gotten the memo, for instance, that rape is not a crime of passion, you know, because that's how it used to be referred to in the statutes. It was a crime of passion. No,
right.
It's a crime of violence.
Yeah.
And the right wing has never gotten that memo. So to expect them to understand that a psychopathic serial child rapist has violence issues and power and control issues instead of, you know, he's just a horny, randy gay man, that's just a little too far for the average right-wing mind, because they want it, they're constantly in search of reasons to re-vilify gay people in this country when it's been shown that there's no problem.
Yeah, no, I mean, the thing, yeah, you know, it's, and the only reason to harp on the conservative Republican aspect of it is because of who they are. I don't want to invoke Dennis Green up in this mug, but they are who we thought they were, okay?
Yeah. Oh, very well done, yes.
I am so sick to death of the right-wing meme, because it's a horrifying reality we find ourselves in, being dominated by this ideology, because it's brutal, and it's producing some really brutal outcomes. Unbelievable. The sort of brutalization of children is like the ultimate in just a decaying society that's fucked up.
Well, I go back to your reference to Tiberius. You know, or was it Jim that referenced Tiberius, who had little children nibble at, you know, playing at fishes, nibbling his feet in the pool? I think it was Jim.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, you know, it's just evidence of a decayed and depraved society that has been decayed and depraved, you know, not by working stiffs, but by its wealth class, its
yeah.
upper class, its rich class, its economically empowered class.
No, I mean, as soon as I heard that sort of pimping to the rich, I immediately flashed to, you know, Rome and whatnot. Because, I mean, that's also just part and parcel of the whole, you know, when there's no kind of soul in a culture like this one, I mean, you know. And when the money and the power is all at the top, you know, yikes, you know? I mean, look out. I don't know what else to say.
I know. Yeah, look for a soft place to land.
My God. And another thing I wanted to bring up right quick was I see that the Democrats are making noise about, get this, making some sort of deal so that these tax cuts won't expire. They're trying to say this is their leverage.
Did that give you a case of the flop sweats, too?
I just feel sick. I'm like, oh, my God, you know?
You got to let the... Look.
It expire already. I mean, you know, and it's just sort of like, I'm sure Bush, them people laughing. Because as soon as they got that law passed, they laughing.
Whose brilliant idea is this? And again, this comes from something we've discussed in the past, Sandra, and that is... The strategy driven from the politics of fear. The Democrats are afraid to let the entirety of the Bush tax cuts expire and then go forward pressing for tax relief for low-income earners, which is the way to go, because
yeah,
they're afraid that the right-winger, see, they raised your taxes down there, Cletus, you know.
Yeah, no, and it's absurd in the face of what's going on the ground. The opportunities just keep coming up for the Democrats, and they show what they are, bought and paid for by the 1%. Because if they can't use the protest that's building on the ground, the vulnerability of the Republicans, and they still ain't going to let the tax cuts expire, then they are culpable too. Okay? And we need to just, us in the Horn family and the other sort of Democratic-leaning types need to realize that and act accordingly. Because I can't do anything else now. I see what they are, Dennis Green again, and gotta go, you know?
Yeah, taking a powder.
I'm just sort of gotta like keep pushing, I guess, in other forms of political activity, because this is not what I want to be reading about. I don't want to be reading about the Democrats figuring out some way to allow the riches of the rich to continue to pay under 40%, you know, and less, proposing 28% and all this sort of madness.
It is, again,
the loophole
again, who's
rid of, one of them they keep talking about is the housing one, which is a middle class engineered tax relief scheme, but it's one that is useful to the middle class. That's the one they're talking about fucking up. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing what's going on. Also, if I may drift right quick, do you know we now have two bankers, one running Italy and one running Greece? How'd that happen?
I noticed that.
You know, I'm kind of like
people in Mediterranean Europe must be waking up with horses' heads in their beds all over the place.
I don't know. I just, you know, that was really disturbing. And so it's like, oh, well, the markets responded because they're pushing austerity. And it's like, damn, we know what austerity is going to bring. That's the thing that kills me about this whole process. It's like, you're not going to get your money. I mean, all you're going to do is brutalize working people. You know,
like David said the other night, were it not for Greece and Ireland and so forth, the headlines would read, UK slipping even further as a result of austerity.
And also, it would also read, the low-wage workers in Germany are getting restive. Trust me. So, no, a whole...
You don't want that.
No, all these people are fucking dreaming. If they think that stepping on the necks of the Mediterranean countries is going to resolve that mess called the Eurozone. It's not. Look at Slovenia. The bond prices were up past 7 today. That's called contagion. I don't know what they call it over elsewhere, but...
I got an email from Randall who sends me some info on tech stuff. You know, we were talking about that virus that was injected into the Iranian systems the other night.
Yes.
Well, that virus was designed to attack. If I understand Randall correctly, it was designed to attack machinery built by Siemens, German.
Oh, right. Interesting. Yeah, well, isn't that one of the largest corporations in the world?
It is. Yeah. And so I guess we can assume that Siemens is the part of the mechanical infrastructure of whatever Iran is trying to do. Randall tells me it targets Siemens industrial software and equipment running Microsoft Windows.
Well, I mean, Germany has been providing equipment for Iran for a while, right? I mean, these are like corporations. They don't represent countries anymore, do they? Don't they just do what the hell they want now?
Yeah, kind of. And by the way, our chancellor of toasters, David, has just said, please tell Sandra that should she get back into sports, for that Dennis Green drop, I'll launder her sweats and tape her ankles for a full year.
Oh, I'm glad he liked that. That's one of my favorite meltdowns. I swear to God, we use that all the damn time because it's so funny.
They were what we thought they were.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Oh, breaking news. President Obama phoned the super committee chairs to not change the triggers. Don't touch the triggers. I mean, you know, this dude, he is too much, okay?
Or too little.
You know, we really want to cut the $1.2 trillion if you can't come to an arrangement. Please. I mean, what is he doing?
By the way, did you know that yesterday morning, and I had emails through the day from a variety of Australian correspondents, emails saying, Bob, what the... is going on with this business about there's going to be a marine base in Darwin, Australia. Did you see that yesterday?
Wow, what is that story coming out of?
Well, it hit yesterday, and it was all proffered up. You know, I mean, it was on the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which is, you know, reasonably reputable. And it was all about how new cooperation and because of the concerns with China... that the United States, we were going to have a brand new, another permanent base in the wider world, and we were going to put a bunch of Marines somewhere around Darwin in the Northern Territories. And so, you know, there was this whole string of what the emails, and I get up this morning, and the first thing I see is, oh, no, there's not going to be either. Apparently that got around quick enough that the Gillard government down in Australia said, oh, no, stop.
Oh, okay, because that just sounds crazy. Especially, yeah, Darwin. That ain't the most hospitable place in the world. But anyway, yikes.
And one last thing just to share with you. I saw something over at Common Dreams today that kind of blew my mind.
Is that Israeli column?
Yeah, Ehud Barak talking about acceptable Israeli losses if they decide to attack Iran.
Yeah, I read that. That was really bizarre. I mean, yeah.
Well, I immediately had to tweet a link to a scene with General Buck Turgidson from Dr. Strangelove saying, "No, I'm not saying we won't get our hair mussed, but losses will be acceptable."
Well, now, and he's a defense minister. And he used to be a member of the Labor Party. I mean, really horrifying. So this is more of the drumbeat, right? To bomb Iran? Is that
yeah.
what this is for?
Yeah, because Ehud Barak has said there won't be more than there will be less than 500 Israeli deaths.
And that was on page 20 of their paper too, right?
Yeah, buried down there behind the right. But the wild thing is, as the writer at Common Dreams points out, that's the same thing in the United States as saying there would be less than 22,000 deaths. There's a cadre in Israel that really, really wants this.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, because, I mean, just the way the media propaganda is going. I mean, these days, anytime you know, a story is pushed, you have to assume that it's by design, and, you know, it's just kind of trying to propagandize some segment of some population. I guess it's us? I don't really know, but...
And that it is part of a prearranged script.
Well, it's prearranged, dialed in for if X event happens, then this event will happen type of scheme, I swear. I don't really know, but I don't know. I guess I'm stuck on the... I'm back to the two bankers running those countries. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I just got an email from Randall saying that Prairie 2, who writes into Malloy a whole lot...
Oh, yeah, that guy, yeah.
...is claiming that Italy's debt burden is low and that because it is minimal, it entirely got scooped up by the banksters who now set the rates. And Randall says, how this is, I can't understand.
Wow. Well, no, they keep talking about how, you know, they actually are operating a surplus in some of their books. So, I mean, their situation is nothing like Ireland and Greece, per se.
In other words, there was something there worth stealing.
Well, yeah, no, that's what it looks like to me. I mean, you know, where you get commentaries in the Financial Times and the Telegraph and all these different writers egging on the suspension of democracy. Oh, we have to do this, and praising bankers running countries now. You know, I'm sorry. I'm disturbed because they caused the problem, and now you put them physically in charge to finish off the people, I guess. I'm not too sure where they're supposed to get the money from when the people are laid out, though. But, you know, that's just me. I don't know where the money comes from when you do the austerity. Did you hear in England that they're desperately trying to cut taxes? That top rate? I'm just like, my God, I mean, it's just coming.
Well, the American disease has certainly metastasized, hasn't it?
Yeah, and they got private corporations taking over hospitals there. Listen, wow, okay? Thatcher's spawn is just really out of control, I got to say.
And it comes to no good end. I mean, that's all you can say.
Anyway, yeah. Oh!
Oh, by the way, the Michigan law is Matt's Safe School Law.
Okay, good. I'm glad someone sent it on.
And Kim and Ray both saying that it is absolutely all over the place in terms of being talked about in Michigan.
Okay, well, good, because when I saw it, I was just kind of like, oh, my God, you know, just disturbed beyond belief because that wasn't the idea of it. And once again, you know, the Republicans protecting their ability to torment and torture people is very sick. And Penn State. Anyway, I'll leave it at that.
All right, Sandra, it's awful good to hear from you.
All right, take care.
Take care. Bye now. Sandra calling from California. a little reminder here at the top of the hour, in the third hour of the program, a brief conversation coming your way with someone very, very, very special. In the midst of all the Sturm und Drang of these various and sundry horrors that are stalking across our nation, a little something interesting transpired yesterday. And that is this. As a result of a lawsuit filed, the grand jury testimony of Richard M. Nixon that was taken after he resigned from office and was therefore protected for his acts in office by the pardon, a lawsuit was filed and the grand jury testimony was revealed, and it came out yesterday. Very briefly, at the top of the coming hour, we will have, and I am honored to say this, we will have a conversation with Stanley Cutler. You may recall Stanley from the Prism West Virginia American History series of this past summer. Stanley Cutler is the man who filed the suit. Stanley Cutler is also the man who filed the suit that got the Nixon papers and the tapes released many years ago. Stanley Cutler will join us for a brief conversation at the top of the hour. Hidden or buried down in the story about the release of the grand jury transcripts, this. Earlier this year, a U.S. district judge ordered the unusual release of the grand jury testimony, and here's the part where you turn on the highlight button, over the objection of the Obama administration. Yeah, really. The Obama administration went to court to protect Richard M. Nixon. Seriously. Not kidding. Is that just the teensy-tinesiest little bit disturbing? It's a whole lot disturbing. That's one of those, Jesus, Barack! Moments. Yuck. But still, from a historical standpoint, it is very important what Dr. Cutler has done, and he is kindly going to join us at the top of the hour, which I am very much looking forward to. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
What's happening, Jim?
You?
Trying.
All these things about Ohio and all that stuff and Sandusky and...
Oh, Pennsylvania, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, I mean.
Yeah, Sandusky, Ohio. It's an easy, yeah.
Right. Well, you know, as far as football is concerned, you know what I think that is.
Well, this is very definitely not a football story.
No. No, I'm sure. But as far as Veterans Day is concerned, there are lots of stories I could tell you about that. And I'm not going to weary you or anyone else with their number and prolixity. However, I have a very personal story that I would like to share.
Do please.
Long ago, when you had Billy Shears on his on your program,
right?
I have a song played for a friend of mine named Mark Reichelt, and I would like to tell you the story about Mark and his family.
Do please.
Mark was a very dear friend of mine, and I love him dearly. And he will always remain in my heart forever. And when I was in Leuven, Belgium, the town that was raped by the Germans, they destroyed everything there practically. As a matter of fact, there was a library that was rebuilt in Leuven or Leuven. And the states that contributed to it are emblazoned upon the building structure. It's one of the oldest cities in Belgium. It is the oldest Roman Catholic university, founded in 1425 in that part of Europe. But Mark's father and mother were living during the German occupation of that city. His father was taken, because he was an engineer, to Yugoslavia to work as a slave labor by the Nazis. His mother was a nurse, and I can still see her now, so proud, with white hair and just a beautiful woman with beautiful cheekbones. But she was also a member of the Belgian resistance and was caught carrying a handgun leaving the hospital one night after curfew. And she was immediately taken to prison to be executed. On the morning of her execution, the Allies had advanced into Louvain. And instead of meeting her executioner, she found her cell door swung open. The executioners were gone. And she stood just 8 hours away from being shot as a member of the Belgian resistance. A nurse, a patriot, a woman who loved her country to the point of risking death instead of being a collaborator. You know, you hear about stories like that. Well, when you sit down and you talk to someone who actually went through that, you'll never forget it.
And you will never be the same.
No.
So did you come to know them in the United States or overseas?
I met Mark in graduate school. And we became close friends, very close. And we traveled a great deal together, and, well, there were tragic interventions. And I can only quote from Eugene Onegin, Canto 51, "The two of us had planned to wander on foreign shores to feast our eyes, but I am here, and he is yonder. Fate has decreed it otherwise."
Sorry for that, Jim.
A very proud family. Hospitable. They were Walloons. They spoke French, as well as Flemish, as well as English and German. But nonetheless, it wasn't like going to the attic in Amsterdam, where Anne Frank and her family lived before they were taken away in 1944. But it was a living memory to me of a woman and her husband who were persecuted, enslaved, and nearly killed by the minions of Adolf Hitler. Just think of it. Spending the night realizing you're going to be shot the next morning. And by some miraculous thing, well, it was a miracle, maybe perhaps, but our view is a miracle. She viewed it as a miracle. Of finding those prison doors swung open. And being allowed to reunite with her husband and have one of the most beautiful children who became my friend that I've ever known, and I love him still.
There is nothing that needs to be added to that, Jim.
That's all I have to say.
Remember well, Jim. It's obvious that you do.
Every day in my heart. I don't think I've ever loved anyone as much as I loved him. Good night, Bob.
History is not words that are printed on a page. When it happens and you live through it or live next to it, they are words printed in the heart. David in Tennessee writing with regard to the Obama administration protecting Nixon. Barack Obama protecting Milhouse. My sails have no wind. It really does say things that you'd rather not have said, doesn't it? Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Uh-oh, we better hurry up for the next guest. Or maybe for the next callers, if I can make this really quick for them.
Yeah, you've got a few minutes.
Well, I mean, if there are other callers on board, I'd rather like I'd let them get their time in too, because since you're
well, Stanley's only going to be on for a few minutes, so there'll be time after as well. So
don't
sweat it, David.
All right, that's good. That's good. Yeah, you know the whole thing about this child abuse thing. This is such an issue that is so cancerous in our entire society through everything. You know, we have a convicted pedophile who just released a movie. And when I say convicted pedophile, I don't mean like a Roman Polanski. I mean a guy that actually went to jail. He actually had he videotaped having sex with a 12-year-old. And he's still making goddamn films. And he only served 3 years, people. And you know, he wasn't white. 3 years! He served 3 years, Bob.
Who is
three
it?
3 years.
Who is it?
It's Victor DeSalva. He made the movie Powder.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He actually videotaped his victim. I didn't know about this. See, this is the thing that I find very interesting. Because when he came out, and he had to work his way back. He actually got into the system of the Disney Corporation. And I can't imagine they didn't know his background. Like, he said, hey, DeSalva, come work for us. It's like, you look at his, you're like, oh, wait a minute, we were out for a few years. He would have to clear all that before he went in the studios. But the fact that they let this guy, this is a problem that we have. Like, and this is why I say it goes beyond white privilege, Bob. This is the problem we have. We put the pedophiles in, and then we take them out, and we say, well, he was showing good standing. No, you don't give somebody for 3 years. And the funny thing is, Bob, when Powder was out, that 12-year-old and his family, they were protesting the fact that they were even putting that movie on the television, on the TV, the fact they couldn't believe it. The guy only served 3 years, and they're already heralding him as a...
Well, maybe, David, you have sort of unearthed one of the sorrier sides of child sexual abuse. Now, I can't speak to other jurisdictions, but the last I checked, here in West Virginia, for instance, an adult who commits the criminal offense of child sexual abuse, which is touching but not penetrating, okay, just to use a sort of shorthand.
Yeah.
A fondler, a diddler, but not an outright rapist.
Mm-hmm.
That person is liable to spend, for one act, not less than one, nor more than 3 years, in the custody of the Department of Corrections of the state of West Virginia.
Mm.
1 to 3. For shattering and otherwise irretrievably and irrevocably altering a life that may extend to the biblical 70. 3 years, no more than 3 years for changing 70?
Right.
And let's get down and sort of honest with ourselves about Jerry Sandusky, if he is convicted. One, he will not be convicted. Mm. He will enter a plea. And the plea that he will enter will expose him to nothing like anybody within the sound of my voice thinks would be appropriate punishment for what he has done.
if it turns out as we are to understand that this would be an indictment that would extend to, what was the word, dozens of little boys, then if you did the calculation and you said that the sentence was to be served consecutively, you know, concurrently, if it's concurrent, that means that you could be convicted on 16 1-3s and still only serve 1-3 because all the sentences are being served theoretically at the same time.
Right.
On the other hand, let's say there's 16 1-3s and they're served consecutively. That's still only 16 years. Now, that might be the rest of Mr. Sandusky's natural life given his present age, but it might not. And let's remember also that the prison system includes concepts of good time, and overcrowding issues mean that we try to get people out of the system as quickly as they... We start working on getting them out of the system as quickly as they get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So while there is national outrage about this, I think a little bit of realism... I think it's worth injecting a little bit of realism into this discussion, and that is, Jerry Sandusky, if convicted, will not serve anything approaching what we consider justice. Because right. most people with a conscience out there think that justice would probably involve the death penalty. But that ain't gonna happen. And he's not even gonna do 20 or 20 to life or 40 or 40 to life or life. It ain't gonna happen. Because this country is still kind of iffy about diddling children, I think, because the legislators who write the laws and create the punishment statutes probably know somebody who's doing it, if they're not doing it themselves. Because these are so often power games. These are power crimes. There's one little county in West Virginia where the beloved family doctor, okay, the beloved family doctor of the community was finally busted for being the diddler that he was. It split that community like an overripe melon. I mean, people are still not talking to other people because of the stance that they took in that case.
Right.
And you want and just as was, I was thinking about this the other day, because of the way that the Jerry Sandusky thing is shaking out, in that case, this individual, who was convicted of doing things to little children in his community, every year, David, he took time off to do public service as a physician and went out and worked with children on an Indian reservation.
And
he wasn't even touched for any of that.
And you know, to add on to that, there is news out that they put out this week that amidst the child rape charges against former Penn State defensive coach Jerry Sandusky comes a Philadelphia TV news report that Ray Grickar, then Central County District Attorney, disappeared in 2005. Grickar, known as a no-nonsense prosecutor, was, according to his nephew, Tony Grickar, beholden to no one and was not a politician. People ask why Grickar did not prosecute the coach. I have no problem saying because he probably clearly felt he didn't have a case for a successful prosecution, Grickar said in that Patriot News interview. Ray's friend, Montour County Robert Buhner, told the newspaper that Ray would have been extremely cautious based on a reasonable likelihood of conviction. You don't want to go after someone high profile unless you have a compelling case. Ray Grickar comes under fire because a 1998 report concerning Sandusky allegedly molesting two boys in a shower did not lead to charges. Under the scope of the findings of the 2011 grand jury, Sandusky admitted to taking a naked shower, touching a boy, and asking for forgiveness. However, 6 weeks later, police closed the case. Grickar disappeared on April 15th, 2005. He told his girlfriend he was going for a drive. His car was found in a Lewisburg, Pennsylvania parking lot, and his laptop, missing its hard drive, was located in the Susquehanna River, the Patriot News stated. Grickar was declared dead in July 2011, although his body has not been
located. Has never been found.
Yeah.
I read about that. you mess with the power structure at your hazard.
Right.
There's a lesson in this, David, because no matter the horror and gravity of it, the power elite will protect its own. You know, Jerry, give me the keys to the shower, Jerry. Look, give me the keys. Let it blow over. It'll all be. But you know, we got to do something, Jerry.
And you know, just to close with this, when we're talking about child pedophilia and sex rings and everything that they were talking about, how they were pimping young boys out. I've mentioned this on the program before. There was a documentary on the Discovery Channel that was supposed to air. On the night, they were supposed to air it in 1994, and on the night, on that very night, they pulled it off the schedule. It was called Conspiracy of Silence. It was about the Boys Town sex ring. And Discovery, without even notifying anyone, they just pulled it completely off. And the only place you can see it now is on the Internet, but there you go. That's what it comes down to, the power structure. They can make anything disappear if they really want to.
And the fact that, as David in Tennessee noted, as this article that I referenced earlier noted, this guy retired from coaching at 55 years old. He could have had, theoretically, I mean, you know, Penn State put up some monster defenses under him. He could have had a head coaching job somewhere. But suddenly the entirety of Division I college football understood that he was damaged goods and not to be touched. I mean, the enormity of this crime, this conspiracy, and I use that term not within the way we usually hear it, but this, but in its legal sense. Jesus, it has to. If the NCAA, if Division I schools were all kind of, you don't want him, then that means. That means that this so-called open secret was huge, and that everybody, not just Joe Paterno, everybody within the framework of the sport sort of agreed to keep quiet. And that means more little boys got raped.
Well, what about letting Mike McQuarrie, they're not letting him coach anymore, I guess, but... the fact that they didn't even say anything like to the newspapers or anything, and just been like, "Oh yeah, I guess we can have a Penn State game with you," even though you were a witness to a child raping and you didn't really do anything except notify the authorities later on. It's insane. I actually went to the Penn State forum for football, and to see a lot of people talk in reverence about coaches, about people you don't even know. This goes back to what I was telling you, Bob, about the cult of personality, the fact when we deal in politics and music and art and all of that, how emotionally connected someone is to someone. And you can't be that. You can't be that. No matter what that person means to you, you can't do that, because the minute you do that, you're anchored and you're going to drown. You will drown in emotions. Look what happened with the Michael Jackson thing, not to harp on that. But the very fact that everyone just constantly comes to his side and comes to anyone's side who is a celebrity without even actually knowing the person, that to me is the most frightening aspect of all.
Well, there's the equally frightening aspect, David, as David in Tennessee is noting, that there, you know, you can correlate from abuser to abused to abuser. In many instances, it is not universal. But one of the things that becomes blindingly apparent is that there must be a sort of manhunt now. And I don't mean that in negative terms. The people that Jerry Sandusky is alleged to have abused, somehow or another, we have got to find out who every last one of those is. Because there has to be some level of intervention lest it perpetuate itself. And so that it doesn't turn out that Jerry Sandusky has created an entire micro community of little Sanduskys to do this somewhere down the road. That's not to say that the victims will, but the possibility exists, and the only way you have even a reasonable chance of defeating the possibility on a large scale is to do interventions and counseling and serious work with the people that he abused. You know, David in Tennessee noting, I'd rather hear these children referred to as survivors than victims. And they are. It is the same as if Jerry Sandusky had tried to kill them but was unsuccessful. They are survivors, not victims. They are survivors of his rapes.
Exactly, and I think the biggest problem that we face now with this case is getting the proper people convicted of acknowledgement of the past, the fact that they, if they had any evidence in the past to know that Sandusky had this kind of psychological profile, and the fact that we just let that go. We can't let those people go. We need to just start we need to bring up the hammer and start hammering left and right every single person who knew. And that is how you begin. Well, you begin part of the healing process that way. You need that severe punishment that is going to rip this community apart, but there is no other way, because if you let this go, I guarantee you it's going to happen even worse the next time. And it might even happen the next time in Penn State.
Another
college.
I think that Sandra is correct. I think the whole thing has got to be shut down for a period of time, because there is such a pervasive pattern of abusive and grossly negligent conduct that there's no way to guarantee that it won't happen again. And the only thing to do is to give those Penn State players their eligibility for the very next year, and let them go out and see if somebody else will have them play on the squad. And if they can't find a spot, then make sure that their scholarships are continued so that they can finish their studies, and just say Penn State doesn't play football for a couple of years.
Well, you know, just to add on to that, I think what they really need to do is they need to talk to the families, the survivors of the families of this rape, and to willing participants, and actually listen to their stories of what they've had to deal with, completely out in the open. So Penn State, so the whole football squad, the whole staff, all the sport communities understand the consequences of this, because they need to hear that, Bob. They need to hear that kind of emotional. That kind of emotional cry for some sort of healing.
At the same time, we should note, David, that there were at the same time that these embarrassing, these really sick in the head riots were taking place in Happy Valley, that there was a candlelight vigil held for the survivors of Jerry Sandusky's conduct, and that was the right thing to do. But moreover, you know, if this rumor unsubstantiated thus far, but if journalists are working on it, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. If this rumor that turns out to be true, that he was actually pimping these children out for wealthy Penn State donors, then it's gonna start having a ripple effect across the pond, because those big time donors to one school talk to the big time donors of another school, talk to the big time donors of another school, and it spreads pretty damn virally.
I hate to be cynical, but I think a lot of those wealthy upper tier donors are pretty much in their ivory towers, so to speak. Because when they start,
yeah, but one ivory tower talks to the other ivory tower.
I understand that, Bob. But
especially within that subterranean universe of enjoying kiddie sex.
I understand that, but some people are just untouchable with their money in that aspect.
Yeah, It may eventually come to the place where it sort of mirrors and tracks with the pervasiveness of child sexual assault and child sexual abuse inside the Roman Catholic Church.
It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out and what happens to the Penn State football faculty and who goes down for it. And I hope a lot of more people go down for it, because if they don't, wow, I can't even imagine what the next incident's going to be like.
Well, I like to think that I have enough integrity that if this was at my alma mater, WVU, I would be saying shut it down. If it was at the University of Alabama, I would be saying shut it down. But there's tons of corruption all the way through it, and it is corruption. It is corrupted, and I want to be really clear about this, David. It is corrupted because it is corrupted by the overarching, overbearing, overweening, relentless drive for more profits. Okay.
Profit is the cancer that is killing us all. That is for sure.
Yeah, David, it's good talking to you. This was a dandy.
All right, Bob. Later.
Take care. Bye now. David, our pop culture correspondent, calling from Maine. Onward. Okay. Well, it's about 10 minutes before the hour. I want to go back to the mailbag before we get Stanley Cutler on the line. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. David in Tennessee noted, for his football work in 1999, Jerry Sandusky won his second Assistant Coach of the Year award, but then he suddenly retires? Yeah, see, it's... it's like little piles on the ground. If you stick a stir, if you put a stick in it and start stirring, the more you stir, the more it stinks. And this is stinking unto the nostrils of the Almighty. Andy writing in about the Barack Obama administration going to the defense of Richard Milhouse Nixon. It's beyond, oh Jesus, Barack. Bob, Mr. Obama is a certified suck-up to power, a pure shill for the powerful, the plutocracy. What more evidence do we need? To grip people, holding back the Nixon tapes is unconscionable. The man's a total tool of the corporatocracy and the defense industrial complex. Just a walking, talking, gutless, vapid, soulless shill of a man. His talk is so, so cheap. Thanks. Nice show, and looking forward to the last hour. Well, we won't have Mr. Cutler for the entire hour. We'll only have him for about 15 minutes. But I know from experience, Ferg and I got to sit down with him at a table in Princeton, West Virginia, alongside Dr. Bill O'Brien, and he is a genial genius of a man. Once I've got him on the line, I don't want to waste any of his time sharing out his accolades and the stories of what he has done with his life on the planet. But just get some of this. This is just the basic biography. This is Stanley Cutler. He has taught most lately in the history department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he also taught periodically in the law school. He is a lawyer. Simply quoting from his bio here, he has written widely in a number of fields of American history, concentrating on American constitutional history and the 20th century. His earliest book was Judicial Power and Reconstruction Politics. His other major books include The Wars of Watergate, The American Inquisition, which won the Silver Gavel Award from the American Bar Association, Privilege and Creative Destruction, the Charles River Bridge case, Judicial Power and Reconstruction Politics, and Abuse of Power, the New Nixon Tapes. That book resulted from his successful lawsuit against the National Archives and Richard Nixon to force the release of the long-suppressed tapes. He also has authored or edited more than a half a dozen textbooks in various fields of American history. His scholarly articles have appeared in leading history and legal periodicals. He edited the new edition of the Dictionary of American History. Just sort of wrap your head around the concept of that, a Dictionary of American History. It's a 10-volume work. It won the American Library Association's Best Reference Book Award. Then he edited the 4-volume Encyclopedia of 20th Century America. He also edited the Encyclopedia of the Vietnam War. The American Library Association gave the Vietnam volume the Best Reference Prize in 1996. The book on the 20th century was awarded the prize for best reference work by the Association of Book Publishers. This is high praise. He is the founder of Reviews in American History. He was its editor from 1972 to 1997. He has been a Guggenheim Fellow, a holder of the Garibaldi Chair in Political Science at the University of Bologna, a distinguished exchange scholar via the National Science Foundation for China, a Fulbright 40th Anniversary Distinguished Lecturer to Peru, the Bicentennial Professor at Tel Aviv University, and a Fulbright Lecturer in Japan. Wow. Stanley's been on National Public Radio, Today, Nightline, oodles of other television programs, and here in a few minutes he will add to his list of credentials an appearance here on the Horn. Maybe we get an asterisk, I don't know. But I can tell you this. You want a good barometer for someone able to engage his expertise on a level that everyone can get their head around? It is this. It is an exhausted 15-year-old boy sitting at a table of men where the discussion is broad, quick, and complicated. And when you walk away from that experience, and that 15-year-old boy looks at you and says, "Dad, I sure wish I could learn from people like Mr. Cutler all the time." That is the measure, the good measure, of genius. So, here in just a few moments, we will be talking with Stanley Cutler about the recent release of the Nixon grand jury transcripts. See, I see what Mr. Cutler did with Nixon to be very much a matter of patriotism, of making our democracy work. So here in a couple of minutes we will be joined by Dr. Stanley Cutler. Just a second. Okay, we'll be joining Dr. Cutler now. Dr. Cutler, are you with us?
I am with you.
Thank you very kindly for taking time to discuss this.
Okay.
I know your time is limited, so I want to
well,
run.
That isn't it. I'm tired.
Well,
dealing with your media folk all day yesterday is not. It's exasperating. And infuriating and exhausting.
Well, I will try to be neither exasperating nor infuriating.
Yeah. So go ahead.
we're pretty low on the food chain, so I didn't even try to get hold of you yesterday, knowing that everybody would be after you.
Well, that was very good. It was very smart of you.
Well, just explain, please, if you would, the genesis of your decision to go after or try to get the release of these transcripts. The release of grand jury transcripts is not something that happens every day.
Oh, excuse me. I didn't know we were ready.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, no. That's fine. That's fine.
Well,
yes.
Well, first of all, it's nice to be with you. I have pleasant memories of our lovely time together this year, and I always have good memories of coming down to West Virginia. I enjoy that very, very much. I like speaking to teachers as I do down there. I feel like I'm doing some good in the world. Well, anyhow, you asked about pursuing these grand jury things. Well, I could tell you that, like Mount Everest, it was there, and that's why I went after it. No, I went after it because, you know, it's one of the few things that we haven't laid eyes hands on. I did not expect it to be of great import substantively, and I was correct in that. There's some interesting stuff. I love one of Nixon's exchanges with the prosecutors. They're talking about selling of ambassadorships for contributions, and Nixon is kind of exercised about this. And, you know, one of his usual answers is, everybody does it, you know, which is true. And he said, after all, what'd you think, that Harry Truman gave Pearl Mester an ambassadorship because she had a big bosom? That sort of thing, that's Nixon being Nixon. He runs the gamut of emotions in here. He's on the one hand Uriah Heep, self-pitying, feeling put upon. Sometimes he's very, very articulate. Sometimes he's angry. Sometimes he's jocular. You know, it's a very real human being you see in all this. Now, I don't think that's what's important out of it, because I think I knew that, and I think most other people who work on Nixon knew that. What was important in this case was the precedent. The judge of the case, a very conservative judge, he's the judge that threw the birthers out of court, though, the day before my case. He's a no-nonsense judge. And his opinion was in two parts. First, he raised the question of, can you see grand jury minutes? Well, it is, you know, part of our history for 700 years, 800 years, even going back to medieval England, that grand jury proceedings are secret. For good reason, many times. But he pointed out that they're not absolutely secret, that there are categories of cases where there are exceptions. And one of the categories is that it's a matter of compelling historical and public interest. He said, Watergate and Richard Nixon are matters of compelling public interest. They proceeded to grant us access on that basis. Well, this is another precedent, another chip in the armor, if you will, on the veil of official secrecy. It seems to me we're always struggling to create more transparency in our governmental actions. And this is just another precedent for it. And, you know, in talking to media people yesterday, they simply didn't get this. I said, you know, access to sources is as important to you as to me. No. They wanted some hot story at the moment. You know, can't you tell me something really new and exciting in this and so forth? And they didn't want to talk about what I think is the larger question. So I'm talking to you about it now.
And I'm glad you are. Stanley, what there was one passage that I read in my brief perusal of the file where he got combative about questions regarding the IRS.
He got combative on a number of issues, and by the way, if we had $100 for every time he said, I don't recall or I don't recollect, including the time that he said, now I'm not going to tell you people that I don't recollect that he proceeded to tell them that he did recollect.
It's like a disease that afflicts Republican presidents, isn't it? When you, or maybe presidents in general, when you see the number of times, for instance, that Ronald Reagan didn't recollect that he could recall that he had a remembrance.
Well, of course. But look, all scoundrels. You don't have to be a Republican to be a scoundrel. come on. Look, I said before the release of the tapes, the transcripts, I said, this is a chance to hear Nixon unplugged because he's in there, his lawyers are there, but he's not allowed to use them. He has no aides. He has no spinmeisters. It's Nixon. Okay. But I said that he would have better sense than a perjurer himself. But he also was still a politician for 40 years who knew how to spin a question, how to deflect it, how to skirt it, how to fudge it in a way. And he does a lot of this here. Not to anybody's great surprise. But listen, before I go any further, I must tell you that a lot of people don't realize that in the release yesterday was something that we have fought for over 15 years. It was part of the settlement of my original case dealing with the tapes, and that was the access to Richard Nixon's dicta belts. Now, these are really important. This involves Richard Nixon's dictating to himself. These were never transcribed. Most of them were never transcribed. And here he really is unplugged. And I sampled a couple of them, and they're kind of interesting. He did this always late at night in the Lincoln Room. And Richard Nixon, who in many ways could barely hold a conversation with another person one-on-one, but with a dictaphone and a dictating machine, he was terrific. So we now have those.
How long, do you have any anticipation for how long the turnaround will be for the transcripts on those?
There won't be any transcripts.
Oh.
No. No, the government's not going to pay to make transcripts. You can listen to them. They're pretty good quality. Pretty good quality.
Okay, so, and that's him at his most personal, is it introspective stuff?
I think so, yeah. And, he's talking... He always told his secretary he didn't want these transcribed because he wanted them for himself. Now, I can't imagine his spending his retirement years, whether it was forced or unforced, listening to hundreds of hours of this. He always claimed, for example, that the tapes would exonerate him. Sure, the tapes would exonerate him if he could gone through them all one by one selectively and picked out the parts made him look good and picked out the parts that didn't make him look good, get rid of those. But he didn't know who had the time to do that.
Well, of course, there's also no explanation for the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. Is that because he wasn't asked about them, or was it another I-don't-recall moment?
He was asked in this grant that he doesn't understand it. Look. You got your, first of all, let me say this. I refuse to believe the 18 and a half minutes is of any significance. This is media hype. The 18 and a half minute gap occurs in the middle of a conversation on June 20th, 1972. He has just returned to the White House from Florida. In the rest of the conversation that we have, what is he talking about? He's talking to his aides about how we're going to contain this Watergate investigation. And he talks about using the CIA to thwart the FBI. Now, in the middle of this is 18 and a half minutes missing. Given the tenor, the remarks that are made before and after, I can't believe there's anything of profound significance in there that is not already implied in the rest of the material. This is a media thing. It's like the media fascination with Deep Throat, where we've known since 1997 when the first tapes came out, we've known since then that Richard Nixon knew in October 1972 it was Mark Felt who did it. And the media refused to recognize that because they were waiting for Bob Woodward to reveal the great secret, which was no longer a secret. The same with the 8.5 minutes. I just find that the energy expended on this is kind of silly. People, we've spent fortunes on tape experts who are trying to recover it. What happened, I don't know for sure. There is some pretty good evidence, however, that it's deliberately erased. And somebody keeps hitting the delete button. And somebody has said, somebody who's not too familiar with how to do this, meaning, of course, Nixon, who was technologically challenged. I don't know. I would accuse him of that, barring further evidence. But to me, I'm sorry, Bob, it's just not important.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because it has that sort of grassy knoll flavor to it that really has grabbed the American attention for a long time.
And the media loves stories to which there are no answers.
And with regard to what you said about Deep Throat, that strikes me now. That's something I've never heard before, that this was basically a matter of deference to Bob Woodward to allow him to drop the other shoe, as it were.
Well, I think so. But that's just my take on it.
Well, let me ask you this, Stanley. Obviously, you initiated this litigation. We're talking about something that happened roughly 35 and a half years ago.
Right.
Is there any takeaway on the fact that the Obama administration's Department of Justice came in and offered even a remotely vigorous defense against your request?
Yeah, well, let me make a couple of comments about that. First of all, the judge was magnificent on this point of 35 years ago. He said, you know, he raised the question of privacy interests. He said, last he heard, Richard Nixon was dead, as were most of the other principals, and those that were alive had been commenting on it for years. In fact, one of the most prominent persons alive is John Dean. John Dean submitted an affidavit saying, I don't care if this is released. So there was no privacy issue. Now, why did the Justice Department resist this? I can't tell you for sure. But let me make two comments. One, there's a kind of ex-president's club out there where these guys cover for one another. And Obama someday, 5 years or 1 year from now, he will be an ex-president. And, for example, when Ronald Reagan was president, he was just issuing executive orders saying that former presidents could invoke executive privilege. Well, by definition, executive privilege belongs to the president, and they're no longer president. That was just ridiculous. Well, he had a retreat on that. The other thing is this: the Justice Department did fight vigorously. Okay, they had 60 days to decide whether to appeal. And when people asked me if I thought they would appeal, I said, seeing the Justice Department does not pursue some of the lesser issues like torture or destruction of CIA records, but they go after the major things, so I would expect them to appeal the order against me of my case. Well, that was tongue-in-cheek. The fact is they did not. The reason why they did not, they waited till the 60th day, by the way. The reason why they did not is because Judge Lambert's opinion was just so good. It's hard to imagine any appellate court would have overruled him. As I said, he's a conservative. He was appointed by Reagan, but he's a terrific judge. And what's unusual about him is, unlike so many of our judges now, he's not predictable. I mean, you know, you have a case, you know exactly how Clarence Thomas, Alito, and Scalia will vote. You know how Ruth Ginsburg and Breyer and others, how they will vote. You know, we have all this predictable justice. Well, Lambert is not that way. First-rate judge.
So it's a combination then of perhaps Barack Obama looking forward versus...
Well, I say that a little bit in tongue-in-cheek, but the fact is they do cover for one another.
Well, this administration has hauled out national security and such as that rather easily in a variety of cases. I was reminded of the fact that shortly after George W. Bush took office, one of his first acts was to bury his father's papers, was it not?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, he did that right away. Sure, that you can't touch a lot of that now.
What does that do to history? What does that do, generally speaking? What does that do to historians and history when they are foreclosed from accessing primary source material?
Unless you fight for it. It's an incomplete story. As we try to write our history, we try to understand it as thoroughly as possible. By the way, you said something about national security. Let me give you an example how it popped up in this recent release. At one point, Nixon is talking about J. Edgar Hoover and his intel program, you know, where they were spying on all kinds of groups. He's talking about that, and Hoover told me about some of the other things they were doing, and suddenly you turn the page, and it said, deleted for national security reasons. And it goes on for pages that Nixon is talking about these other activities, and... You can't find out what they are because 40 years later there's a national security blanket. What national security means in this case is that the FBI was doing something it should be doing, but we're going to continue to protect them by hiding it. That's what it means.
And that's not evidence.
Could there possibly be a national security reason today, 40 years later? Could there be a protecting a source, somebody who was betraying somebody else after 40 years? What are you going to do to the person?
Might we think of this, instead of thinking in terms of national security, Stanley, might we think of this as the national embarrassment exception? That it was embarrassing more than it was relating to the security of the United States?
Sure. Wow.
Well, this has been a magnificent discussion.
I'm glad to do it. As I said, I have my friends down there, and I always enjoy coming down to be with you people.
Well, okay. Just on a separate note, let me tell you that you did that evening that we had our discussion, and you do continue to thrill and inspire a certain 15-year-old high school student who happens to live in this house. I told him you were going to be on the show this evening.
Thank you very much, Bob.
He was tickled.
Thank you,
Stanley. Have a good evening. Bye now. Stanley Cutler. On the release of the Nixon grand jury tapes. By the way, for those of you who would like to do it, you can read the grand jury testimony. It's there. I found it. There's a direct link to it at the Politics Now blog of the Los Angeles Times. I'm sure it's at other sites as well. Having just heard about these dicta belts, I gotta do, as Stanley described it, I gotta sample some of that. Just to hear, because he's not, Rosemary, take a memo to Henry. No, it's not that. It's him talking to himself. And Nixon couldn't have a personal relationship with practically anyone, but he was great when he was talking to himself. So I'm gonna see what I can do about finding these dicta belts and see if I can at least listen to the audio. It's a pity there won't be transcripts. Because, Lord, wouldn't you love to just read? But listening to it, then again, there's a lot of value to simply listening to his voice. Because there are those stories, and I don't know if they're apocryphal or real, of Nixon in some sort of liquor and pill-induced haze wandering around the White House talking to the portraits. Abe, they just don't understand me. If only they understood me, Abe. Well... We could do so many great things, Abraham. Queer football. Kind of makes you a little bit amazed that we're still here, doesn't it? But many thanks to Stanley Cutler for his time this evening. He is an amazing man, a tremendous scholar, and has done great work on behalf of the Republic. 19 minutes past the hour. Like I told David when we were talking earlier, yeah, there would be more time after Stanley Cutler. And there is. If you want to jump into the conversation, do please feel free to do so. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877-4-HEAD-ON, or head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email comes in to AID. And, sorry, David, I tend to know what the political status of your state is more than I do. It is Veterans Day. Down Nashville, Tennessee way, they're holding the Preserving Freedom Conference. Anytime you see a conference named Preserving Freedom, you can fascists and heads and jackbooted thugniacs. Yeah, those guys are all there. Eli Clifton and Lee Fong from Think Progress have attended. They filed a report from the Preserving Freedom Conference in Nashville. And they write, and I'm simply reading their copy, State Representative Womack, that's W-O-M-I-C-K, usually it's Womack, but this is a Womack. Rick Womack, R-T-N, has made no secret of his anti-Muslim views. Remember, they've been having a hissy in Middle Tennessee about a mosque. Remember, some right-wingers tried to burn it down and so forth? Yeah. Well, that little bit of business is being expanded. State Representative Rick Womack gave an interview at the Preserving Freedom Conference. The logo says, Tennessee Freedom Coalition, bringing truth to light. These freaks don't even have the common sense to keep their weird bigotry to themselves when they have an ample opportunity to do so. Here's an example. For Veterans Day.
So, yes, I personally, I don't trust one Muslim in our military because they're commanded to lie to us to the term called taqiyya. And if they truly are a devout Muslim and follow the Quran and the Sunnah, then I feel threatened because...
You'll be forced out.
Absolutely, yeah. I think...
So I don't have to leave after all. Hopefully everything will. Let me just put a note here in that. Now it wasn't weather related, Lottie. It was something related upstream at the server. Couldn't connect, and then suddenly I could connect again. So hallelujah, we're back. 29 minutes remaining in the program. And you know what? You probably just missed the best radio I have ever done. These things happen. There's no record of it. It's just gone into the ether. Those moments of unmitigated brilliance. No, I kid, I kid, I kid. I played some audio of Nixon's dictabelts, especially one that pointed where he was directing Bob Haldeman to press forward on creating a group whose sole purpose would be to attack critics of the administration. Charming, right? And typical. Just remember that repiglick and perfidy and evil and nastiness and vileness and hatefulness have roots that go way back, long tap roots into a wellspring of absolute poison and venom. Just say it. So if you want to get involved in the last 28 minutes or so of the program, you are more than welcome to. Let me get a couple of emails back. Thanks to everybody who wrote in to say that the stream had gone south. And just need to respond to people and let them know that we're back. I would like to know why this is happening, and I suspect I do know because of some other problems that we've been having of late. I think it'll probably be sorted out over the weekend. I had a memo from Ben Birch letting me know. That he would be running a scan this weekend. Never a dull moment. Last week there were attacks on Malloy's White Rose stream. This week there have been attacks, apparently, on our website, such that folks are having to go through a side door to get to the chat room. I'm sorry for all of it, but it is what comes with running something very much on limited resources. Thank you, by the way, for everyone who has been contributing. We are close to being on schedule for this time of the month, the 11th or so. We are not there yet, and we can use all of the kind support that we can get, especially considering the rather dire circumstances in which we finished October. I'm still paying October bills and, November. but you have made that possible, and for that I am very much grateful. We all are. You know, just to make brief mention of something, because it's kind of cute and funny, if you are a regular listener to this program, you know that from time to time, as happened this evening, our exchequer of toasters, Chancellor of Toasters, David in Tennessee, will catch a quip or a phrase or something that smacks of comedic brilliance or genius, and will then award the evening's toaster. We've been giving away imaginary toasters for a long time now. And lo and behold, today I was looking in my email and I was followed by a tweeter whose tweet handle was Virgin Mary Toast. I thought, well, and you know, when I try to follow back, so if you follow me on Twitter, you can expect me to go and look at your profile, and if you're not some spammer, I'll follow you back. Well, imagine my delight when I went to look at the tweet of Virgin Mary Toast and found out that it's a little business enterprise. They're not spammers. It's one of those genius little moments of creative energy. If you go to Burnt Impressions, B-U-R-N-T, Impressions.com, or JesusToaster.com, you will see that there is a company, and I believe they are out of Vermont, that manufactures toasters that will toast the image of the Savior into your bread so that you don't have to wait for miracles to be randomized, for that Kaiser roll to sort of deflate and deform until it just turns out to look like Mother Teresa. They make Jesus toasters. They make Virgin Mary toasters. They make paw print toasters. And they're all for sale for a relatively low, low price of $31.95, including shipping. Now, don't run off and buy them yet, because I dropped them a note. I hope they're for real. I really, really do. I think they are. I dropped them a note, and we are the first member of their affiliate program. So at some point in the future, especially after we get some of these website kinks worked out, and John will be talking to Ben, and I'll be talking to John, and we'll all be talking together, and we'll get them all sorted out, there will be some banners for Burnt Impressions, JesusToaster.com, that kind of thing. And I think if you order online, you'll get a... I think we'll get 10% of the purchase price contributed back toward the horn. Now, everybody makes toast, right? And it doesn't have to be Jesus. It could be the Virgin Mary. It doesn't have to be the Virgin Mary. It could be a paw print. I mean, there's all kinds of fun stuff. And apparently they're even willing to do... specialized images. Shucks, maybe we could send them a copy of the horn logo, and it could be the horn logo on one side and something on the other. Who knows? Or, you know, you've won a toaster. Who knows? As I said. But I thought it was really good fun, and you might want to go and have a look, because I hope it's for real. It certainly looks that way. And if it is, and I expect it is, we'll have those banners up in fairly short order. JesusToaster.com. And also, since it is Friday on the front porch, and we do try to do some lighthearted stuff along the way, another story out of Tennessee, out of Nashville. It's not like I'm just picking on Tennessee. These things just happen this way. WSMV-TV reporting 2 days ago, an airport police officer was taken to the hospital after he accidentally shot himself in the hand Wednesday morning, according to airport spokeswoman Emily Richard. The officer's injury is not life-threatening. Investigators are still trying to figure out what exactly happened. A medical unit with the Nashville Fire Department responded to the situation. The officer, whose name has not been released, was taken to Vanderbilt Medical Center. The shooting occurred at a fire hall at the airport. Fife. The name is Fife. Bernard Fife. You know, there's a reason law enforcement uniforms have shirt pockets, and that there are flaps over the shirt pockets, and that shirt pockets have buttons. It's because the shirt pocket is where Barney's bullet goes. How many episodes did we see of the Andy Griffith Show where Barney would cheat and put his bullet in and reach for his gun and shoot the floor? Well, Barney got his hand this time. I hope the guy's okay, but what do you want to bet it was a Glock? Maybe it was a wheel gun, but I'd just about bet you even money it was a Glock. Even as a gun owner, I would not own a Glock. Because it's, you know, it's got that little safety within the trigger thing, so that if you grab the gun, you can shoot yourself. Right after the New York Police Department first started carrying Glocks, they had a little rash of injured police officers from cops shooting themselves with their Glocks because they were used to dealing with firearms that either had safeties or else wheel guns where they fully understood the meaning, the consequences of grabbing it by the trigger. Fife. Bernard Fife. Oh, Indiana Poppy. Poppy, yeah. Gotta have a Che Guevara toaster. No, there will not be a Boba the Hutt toaster. Just trying to get yourself in trouble, aren't you, Lottie? Yeah. So, now, where to... by the way, if you want to go hear the Dictabelt Nixon stuff, they're little clips, and they've been selected, but still. NixonLibrary.gov, virtual library. So go to NixonLibrary.gov and look in the virtual library there. And you'll find it under the file Dictabelts. You know, it's funny, the photograph they've got of Nixon on the Dick DeBelt's page makes his nose look about 3 inches longer than it actually was. Maybe, well, it's the irony of Pinocchio, I guess. So as we move toward the end of tonight's program, it is Veterans Day. And some numbers I thought you might find interesting. First of all, happy birthday to all the members of the Marine Corps, past and present, out there. The Marine Corps celebrated its birthday yesterday. My good friend Bo Webb is a Marine, and I made a special point of wishing him happy birthday to the Corps in a phone call. Some statistics have come to light, and they are worth mentioning. If you want, you know, we've talked in the last couple of weeks about things like towns that shut off their lights, their street lights, towns that remove their street lights because they have been so preyed upon that there is no longer the money to pay the light bill because of the dysfunction that stalks this nation. And we see those and other stories as signposts on the road to the degradation of this country, our republic, our union. Well, here are a couple more signposts. These are numbers relating to veterans. And it is only fair to suggest that these numbers will get worse and not better. We don't candy coat things here at the Horn. These numbers will get worse and not better because of the frivolous waste of the military that was committed by George W. Bush in his criminal, bloodthirsty, sick, psychopathic adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan. Here are some realities for veterans in the United States. There is a quantifiable rate at which people become homeless in the United States. Within that rate, veterans are 50% more likely than other Americans to become homeless. This, despite the stated desire of the Obama administration to end homelessness among veterans by the year 2015. I don't know how you do that without letting the Bush tax cuts expire in whole. I saw a tweet from Matt Osborne earlier, and Matt, of course, is a veteran. He was responding to someone else. And Matt said, "Don't say thank you for your service to me. Just pay your taxes with a smile." Considerable amount of profundity there. You want to thank a veteran? Help save the country that the veteran was willing to risk his or her life to preserve. Yeah? On any given night in the United States, referred to by the right wing as the greatest nation in the world. On any given night in the United States, somewhere in the Union, variously, there are around 75,000 homeless veterans. And they are of all stripe, all color, across a broad range of age and gender. But as you go to sleep tonight on this Veterans Day 2011, as your head hits the pillow, there are 75,000 thereabouts veterans who have no place to live and no place to sleep, who do not know where their next meal is coming from. In the last 5 years, bearing in mind that George Bush's misadventures in Central Asia and the Middle East began in 2001 and 2003, respectively. In the last 5 years, something on the order of 20,000 veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have been homeless, Within the overall homeless population, the Veterans Administration says that 5.5% are veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. These are not veterans, you see, for whom there was a long, slow slide into despair. These are veterans for whom the disaster hit almost as quickly as they got home. And as R.L. Smith notes in the chat room, and then you add in the wives and the kids, and you begin to see the emerging picture of a genuine American tragedy. On this Veterans Day, it is worth remembering that veterans have been preyed upon by the 1% in disproportionate numbers. You send somebody to war and you hope that they will be able to focus on being at war, because that's how you hope to keep them alive, by being in that brutal moment at all times. But that isn't the case. We have sent people to foreign adventures who the whole time they were gone had to worry about losing their homes. Wells Fargo, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, according to a recent lawsuit, quote, defrauded veterans and taxpayers out of hundreds of millions of dollars by disguising illegal fees in veterans' home refinancing loans. The VA educational benefits that are often an inducement for people to join the military have been a target of the 1%. A lot of the for-profit universities that you see advertised, why, they're owned by Wall Street investment banks, by the 1%. And they were created solely with the purpose of sucking up that money, because, you know, you don't want a veteran going to a real school when you can just give them a draw spunky back of the matchbook course and suck up all their benefits and leave them flapping in the breeze. They go by a variety of names.
but to my mind, they are something damn near traitorous. We would do well to learn history. That stuff that I'm forever going at, hammer and tongs. We would do well. Because a disenchanted veterans population has proven to be the most critical aspect of whether or not a nation state survives or fails more times than historians can count. From the veterans issues that faced the Greeks and the Romans, up through the willingness of yeoman soldiers to rise up against their rulers through the Middle Ages, and into what we call the modern era. One of the first crises that struck that faced the new young republic was how to pay off the veterans it had sworn to compensate and then lacked the money with which to do it. Alexander Hamilton figured out a way. We issued bonds to the veterans that we promised we'd pay off in due time. And then Mr. Hamilton and his cronies from the 1% of that era figured out a way to screw the veterans out of what little they had with a refi scheme that left them being paid literally pennies on the dollar and left the bonds, which would then be bought back by the government, in the hands of people who would become filthy rich and whose progeny, in large part, remain filthy rich to this day. Damned well worth remembering. Remember, remember. I like the fact that, and I saw it mentioned in the chat room, I like the fact that Veterans Day is referred to as Remembrance Day in some other countries. We would be far better to call it that here as well. For Veterans Day is a call to memory. In some cases where memory is all that remains. So thanks for a great week of broadcasting. I really appreciate your input and your participation, however you have done it, whether it be in the chat room, via email, phone calls, what have you. You are the ones who make all of this worthwhile. It's in the interaction, not in my filibobstering, that purpose is found. Thank you for your kind financial contributions, your gifts. They are unfortunately necessary to keep all this going, and we are grateful for what you send. And certainly we can always use whatever you can share. Back on Monday, and a program reminder, we will have a PRISM West Virginia Dr. Bill American History Chat on Tuesday. So I'm certainly looking forward to that. That will start, as usual, at 7 p.m. and run till 9 p.m. Thanks to our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Reverbo is our op-ed correspondent, Cavalcade of Crazy, headonradionetwork.com. My head writer is David in Tennessee. John Fox is a man of many talents and will be addressing issues relating to the website over the course of the weekend. Thank you, John. Thank you to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Since 2002, well, Ben Birch just about single-handedly saved liberal progressive radio by creating a home for it on the Internet, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest-working
bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. I cannot encourage you enough to go to crmw.net, sign up, become a member. You don't have to live in Appalachia to be a part of the solution to the Appalachian apocalypse. And by supporting the work of Coal River Mountain Watch, you are that. I am amazed and humbled by the ability to work side by side with them. I'll be seeing them this Sunday in Charleston as we stand up for a generation as yet ungotten and unborn. At the inauguration of a governor who said, in response to the study that points to the birth defects caused by mountaintop removal, "Well, every day somebody says something makes you sick." That's Sunday. Have a great weekend, everybody. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next, only on the Horn.